What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Oshrat Barel, our past Mevina on Israel on Too Jewish, discussing her experiences during the recent Gaza war and the world's response to it. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. There are some weeks when there is generally no real news from Israel, and there are other weeks, plenty of them, when all the news feels like rehashed old news. Whether these are painful tales of the replaying of old wars that change nothing important, or repeated accounts of indecisive elections and political gridlock, sometimes Israeli news doesn't feel very new. But then, this week, by golly, there is some genuinely new news out of Israel. Believe it or not, after 12 years of the prime ministership of Bibi Netanyahu, a new Israeli governing coalition has been formed, and the next prime minister of Israel will not be Benjamin Netanyahu. Opposition leader Yair Lapid officially informed President Reuven Rivlin and Knesset Speaker Yariv Levin late last Wednesday night that he, Naftali Bennett of Yamina, and United Arab List Chairman Mansour Abbas agreed to a power-sharing arrangement that means that for the first time since the early days of Barack Obama's first term as president, somebody else will become Prime Minister of Israel. I commit to you, Mr. President, that this government will work to serve all the citizens of Israel, including those who aren't members of it, will respect those who oppose it, and do everything in its power to unite all parts of Israeli society. Lapid said to Rivlin at 11:35 p.m., 25 minutes before his mandate to form a government was to expire. In this historic event, Yamina leader Naftali Bennett, Yair Lapid, and Ra'am chairman, that is, the United Arab List, not to be confused with the Joint Arab List, don't ask. Anyway, Mansour Abbas all signed an agreement at a meeting very late Wednesday night at Ramat Gan's Kfar HaMakabiya Hotel. This will be the very first coalition deal, by the way, ever signed onto by an Arab party in Israel's history. The back-and-forth negotiations to form the government went right down to the wire. Abbas added last-minute demands Wednesday following multiple conversations with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was trying to persuade Abbas to join his right-wing and religious party-based coalition. So, after Netanyahu offered to cancel a law enforcing fines on illegal Arab building if the four Arab members of Knesset came into his government, Abbas simply demanded the same from the unity government being formed before he joined them instead. The decision was hard, there were several disputes, but it was important to reach agreements, Abbas said after signing the deal. Another coalition deal was signed with the New Hope Party, led by Gideon Sa'ar, a former ally of Netanyahu and a right-winger now turned political opponent, which is true of many people in this coalition. The very complex governing deal with the Tikva Chadasha New Hope Party guarantees splitting the role of attorney general, preventing Palestinian construction in Israeli-controlled Area C of the West Bank, and, of all things, legalizing the usage of cannabis. The New Hope Party received the justice, education, construction, and communications portfolio, all important. In another compromise, Naftali Bennett's number two in the right-wing Yamina Party, member of Knesset Ayelet Shaked, accepted a rotation in the Judicial Selection Committee with Labor leader Mirav Mikhaeli. But then Mikhaeli demanded to go first, which Shaked also had requested. One way to resolve the dispute that was discussed was a rotation of portfolios during the second half of the term. Shaked will become justice minister. New Hope leader Gideon Saar will shift from justice to foreign affairs, and Bennett will move from prime minister to interior minister and alternate prime minister when Lapid becomes prime minister in 2 years if all this holds together. Mikhaeli might also be promoted during that scenario. Lots of complicated job training among leaders of the various parties. Mikhaeli eventually accepted the agreement that gives Shaked the right to serve in the Judicial Selection Committee first. In return, Labor got the chairmanship of the Knesset Law and Constitution Committee. Mikhaeli said she was proud to make history in ousting Netanyahu, as did everybody involved in this, to be frank. Lapid had to tell President Reuven Rivlin and Knesset Speaker Yariv Levin by 11:59 p.m. on Wednesday night that he could form a government. If he hadn't done so, the mandate would have gone to the whole Knesset, where any member had the opportunity to build a coalition with the support of 61 members of Knesset. Well, anyone could try anyway. Lapid wanted to inform Levin that he had formed a government during Wednesday's Knesset session to make sure that the Knesset speaker would schedule a vote of confidence in the new government and swear in the new ministers this coming week. But final deals weren't reached quite in time. Once Levin, a close ally of Netanyahu, got word from Lapid that a government was ready, he insisted on waiting as long as permitted by law to maximize pressure on the Yamina members of Knesset, right-wingers all, to defect to Netanyahu. This could take another 12 days, or something like that anyway. Marathon talks among representatives, the eight parties set to join the coalition at the Kfar HaMakabia Hotel, finalized Israeli coalition agreements with every party last Tuesday night. Included a deal with Blue and White, the centrist party led by Benny Gantz. Blue and White agreed to a number of central policy areas in advance and to strengthen democracy and Israeli society at large. Gantz will remain defense minister. All of this just means that the messiest coalition in Israel's complex political history is banded together to form a kind of national unity government of parties and people whose main mission was to get Netanyahu out. How this ultra-complex, slim-majority coalition government is going to work, or even hold together very long, is a mystery. Remember, it includes a right-wing, pro-settler, modern Orthodox prime minister in Naftali Bennett. By the way, the very first observant Jew ever to become prime minister of Israel. Bennett personally has only 8 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Then it's also got a centrist rotating in next prime minister in Yair Lapid, who has only 16 or so seats, a Russian party, devoutly secularist right-wing leader in Avigdor Lieberman, a former Netanyahu lieutenant in Gideon Saar, who is devoutly right-wing, plus the left-wing Labor Party and the much farther left-wing Meretz Party, and then finally the United Arab List under Mansour Abbas, the first appearance of an Arab party in a governing coalition. Wow. That is quite a grouping. They are currently tied together by hatred of Bibi Netanyahu, of his corruption and seemingly endless tenure as prime minister. Kids are going to be bar mitzvah next year, who only had Bibi as the prime minister. And Bibi's fascinatingly manipulative ways of conning other politicians out of their shorts on a regular basis just to stay in power. It remains possible Bibi will peel off a few of the coalition's members, especially from Bennett's Yamina right-wing party, and throw the whole thing back into the Knesset or a new election. But for now, thanks mostly to Yair Lapid's nearly superhuman efforts to build a very unlikely government coalition, it looks like Netanyahu will finally exit the prime minister's residence after 12 years. And Israel will have a truly new government for however long it lasts. And so to play us in this morning, here's the Idan Reichel Project from Israel with Israeli Arab singer Nasreen Kadri singing lead, Eze Yom Tov. This is indeed a good day. מה שבבא יבוא אחד יבוא קרוב שישאר איתי לא יעזור ושישטח לי המזל איזה יום טוב יש ימים לא יכולה לנשום לילה רודף יום למצוא מסתור למצוא מקום
לשפוך לי המזל איזה יום טוב תמיד זה בקרוב ונעלם בלילה אין לי יום ואין לי לילה שישלח לי מלמעלה איזה יום טוב איזה יום טוב תמיד זה בקרוב שישלח לי המזל איזה יום טוב תמיד זה בקרוב ונעלם בלילה אין לי יום ואין לי לילה שישלח לי מלמעלה איזה יום טוב איזה יום טוב תמיד זה בקרוב
That was Israeli Arab singer Nasreen Kadri with the Idan Reichel Project. Eze Yom Tov. What a good day. When we return on To Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Oshrat Barel, a good friend and our longtime Mivina in Israel here on To Jewish, joins us from Israel, sharing stories about her own experiences during the recent Gaza War and reflecting on the world's response. Hear from Oshrat when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Or come in person. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson. We will continue to have our services live and in person, but also with full music by Virtual Experience Weekly on Facebook. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is also available in blended formats as well, live or on Zoom, and we're signing kids up for the fall. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, we just had our first one, it was great, and our high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing synagogue and warmest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona, and its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, a good friend of our program, Oshrat Barel, who was our Mivinah on Israel for many years. I don't want to mention how many years, and is talking to us directly from Israel, really in the aftermath of the Gaza War. Good morning and welcome back to Two Jewish, Oshrat. It's good to hear your voice.
It's so good to be back and to reconnect with you. So thank you for the opportunity.
So give us a little bit of an idea of where you were when the recent Gaza conflict broke out. Tell us a little bit about your experience then.
It is really hard to explain it, but for us it was almost a routine. I know it sounds weird, but it is weird as it sounds. This time, you know, I had an addition. I had my personal contribution to the IDF by giving them Yuval.
Yeah.
And Yuval, yeah.
Your daughter's on active service now. She's in the IDF, right?
Yes. And she's serving at an elite rescue unit. So it's very combat, and it's very in the front line. I mean, rescuing, of course. It was very tough as a mom. Now I understand what is a night no sleep, like really no sleep. So that's a personal view. With more, I would say, still personal, but more general, is like... it was, as I said at the beginning, kind of routine, but it was a bit unique because even though we got used to get missiles from Gaza, I think the whole thing in the cities in Israel was surprising. Surprising with the intensity of it, with the number of cities that were involved. Most of the mixed cities in Israel, from Ramleh Lod to Jaffa to a little bit Nazareth, Akko, and others. I mean, I don't recall, you know, the last time that people were afraid to leave from one city to another if there are some Arab villages around. I mean, that's what most of the conversations right now is about. This new feeling of fear.
This was kind of a shocking turn of events. People that have lived as neighbors and everybody thought things were going well for a very long time in cities in which Arab-Jewish cooperation was, you know, sometimes even modeled. Now there were riots in the streets. That's not something we've seen before.
Yeah, but I, having said all of that, I do want to mention what... I always used to say in my time in Tucson and in general that we need to remember that this is not the majority, even though, you know, it was really scary, but it's not the majority. It's not, I can't say that every second Israeli Arab was outside. This is not true. I mean, but you know the problem, you know, the minority that is very vocal, and the majority, the famous majority that is staying like quiet.
Right.
And that's the problem.
We will talk much more with Ashrat Barel, briefing us from Israel in the aftermath of all the Gaza conflict when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-award.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week, Tom, about Sicily, which has a fascinating and almost unbelievably complex history of various conquerors and cultures. And I think we left it when Spain had taken control, but I don't think we got to the Jewish population of Sicily.
Right. Well, for many centuries, Spain was firmly in control of Sicily, which was defined differently in the course of these centuries. At some points, it was only that big island that we know as Sicily today. And at other points, it was the kingdom of the two Sicilies that had one capital in Naples and another in Palermo. And
which aren't that close together, are they?
No, they're not that close. But basically, Naples and points south in Italy were often known as Sicily as well, because Sicily was most famous and most ancient, blah, blah, blah. But Naples was also part of the Greek world, just like Sicily was. And there were always commercial links between Naples and Palermo. And, you know, in the period since Italy became unified and independent, which was 1871, the whole south, but basically what used to be the kingdom of the two Sicilies, which the Italians today call the Mezzogiorno, the south, was dirt poor and violent. And so it was a home to things like the Casa Nostra and the Mafia and all that. It was also a net exporter of labor. So a lot of people who do sort of menial jobs in the north of Italy, like Milano, Florence, whatever, Siena, are actually Sicilians who sought economic opportunities in the north. You also find the same category of Sicilians in Switzerland and Germany and Austria, because there were no jobs. So it's amazing that so many different nations and kingdoms and empires over the years fought so hard from Sicily. It's a testimony to the fact that it was once very wealthy and very prosperous. In any case, part of its economic decline came as a result of first French rule and then the Spanish branch of the Bourbon royal family, which also ruled in France. And during 1492, when the infamous Alhambra decree was implemented to expel all the Jews and Muslims from Spain proper, the decree applied as well to Sicily, where all the Muslims had basically already been chased out by the Normans, but now it was the Jews' turn. And they left slightly later in 1492, in fact, on December 31st, rather than early August, because they managed to collect a very sizable bribe in the form of gold coins to prolong their stay in Sicily for a few months in the vain hope that that prolongation would continue and be years and years. It wasn't, unfortunately. And for all intents and purposes, at least on the official record, from the end of 1492 until well into the early 21st century, Sicily had no formal Jewish life.
None. So the Jewish life that we see in Sicily is a reimportation, if you would, a reinvigoration after the expulsion.
Yeah, and we can talk about that next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Jewish boy is failing at math. His mother tries everything, special classes, private tutors, even a summer at math camp. Nothing works. He keeps failing math. Desperate, she decides to send her son to a Catholic school that a friend recommends. The boy comes home the first day, runs straight to his room, stays there studying until it's time for bed. This continues every night for the whole semester. On the last day of the term, the boy brings home his report card, and his mother is astonished and delighted to find he's gotten an A in math. She says, "Zach, you got an A in math. I'm so proud of you. Are the nuns really as good teachers as Jody said they were?" "No," the boy says. "Then what is it? How come you're so good at math all of a sudden?" "Well, Ma," he says, "when I walked into that school and saw that poor guy nailed to the plus sign, I knew those nuns weren't fooling around." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and do well at math. And now a word of Torah. This week our portion features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. To recap last week's Torah portion, the people of Israel have come to the borders of the Promised Land just 2 years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies comes back with a poor report. "We're not strong enough to conquer the land." Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. That rebellion fails, and a disastrous verdict is proclaimed. A lack of faith in God lies at the heart of the problem, and God decides this generation can never come into the Holy Land and will have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years until they are all gone. Only then can a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth and untainted by slavery and its mentality, come forward into the Promised Land. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Levite named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. Korach accuses his fellow Levites, Moses and Aaron, of chutzpah, hubris, overweening, pride, and egotism. Born into the same tribe, Korach is an insider rebelling against his own kin. "Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us?" he asks. His rebellion threatens the very foundations of Israelite leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, if it's all a matter of personal ego and self-aggrandizement, well, they might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery. And some propose now to do just that. But Korach dissembles. He lies. Moses has no great desire for his high office. He has held it as a sacred trust thrust on him by God. Korach threatens God's authority, not Moses' authority. To determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great outdoor contest is held, a kind of religious challenge match. The net result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed, while Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. You know, it's nice when God has your back on these deals. One lesson of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we need to look in the mirror. The more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, and which is focused on personal aggrandizement, will fail. Only through faith and devotion will we reach our own promised land. When we come back, Oshrat Barel, a good friend of Two Jewish and mine, and our longtime Mivinah in Israel, joins us from Israel, sharing stories about her own experiences during the recent Gaza war. Learn about those and the impression of a real Israeli towards world opinion right now when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Jewish Agency Chairman Isaac Herzog will be the 11th president of the State of Israel. He got 87 votes from members of Knesset in a secret ballot in the Knesset plenum. Herzog's opponent, Israel Prize-winning educator Miriam Peretz, received just 27 votes. Three MKs abstained. Had she been elected, Peretz would have become Israel's first woman president. Still, it was the largest victory in any presidential election in Israel's history. Herzog will take over from President Reuven Rivlin when his term ends July 9th. Unlike prime minister, the position of president of Israel, which goes for 7 years, is largely ceremonial. But a good president has the ability to bring the whole nation together, as the last two, Reuven Rivlin and Shimon Peres, have. A veteran politician, Herzog is a former head of the Labor Party, a former opposition leader, a former welfare and diaspora minister, and the son of Chaim Herzog, who served as Israel's president from 1983 to 1993. Herzog will be the very first son of a president to become president in Israel. Herzog thanked all the Knesset members who voted for him, said it was an honor to serve the whole people of Israel, and called Peretz a hero and an inspiration, even though she lost. "I will be president of everyone," Herzog said, singling out Israelis across the political spectrum and, importantly, diaspora Jewry. Herzog said he was ready to work with any government and any prime minister. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and Yamina leader Naftali Bennett, who will replace him, congratulated Herzog and wished Peretz well. Rivlin spoke with Herzog on the phone and called Peretz to thank her, too. "I send you my warmest greetings, Mr. President," Rivlin said to Herzog. "I can tell you the responsibility of the role you're about to assume is unlike anything you've done till now. The Jewish and democratic system we've established here in the land of our ancestors has a body and soul. If the Knesset is a place of argument, as we've certainly seen recently, the president's residence is a place of discourse, partnership, and statehood." Rivlin said the title of first citizen and the task of guarding the character of the State of Israel are very heavy responsibilities. "I have no doubt you will bear these responsibilities superbly," Rivlin said. "I am proud to pass on the baton to you in a month's time." Should be noted that Reuven Rivlin has been an outstanding president and is universally respected in Israel and throughout the Jewish world. In a distressing chain of events, last week the chancellor and provost of Rutgers University, which has the largest Jewish population of any college student body in America, well over 6,000, apologized for an email they sent out condemning the dramatic and terrible rise of American anti-Semitism when a Palestinian student group protested it. The sequence was horrifying. A week ago, Wednesday, Rutgers University Chancellor Christopher Molloy and Provost Francine Conway sent an email to the student body condemning the dramatic rise in anti-Semitism in America that was experienced during the Gaza war conflict between Israel and the terror organization Hamas. In their message, Molloy and Conway condemned the sharp rise in hostile sentiments and anti-Semitic violence in the United States, as well as recent incidents of hate directed towards Jewish members of our Rutgers community. Molloy went on to connect these to other injustices in America, referencing Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, Hindus, Muslims, indigenous peoples, and the murder of George Floyd. But then, after Palestinian students protested virulently on the all-powerful social media platforms that any condemnation of anti-Semitism in America, and apparently New Jersey, must also acknowledge Palestinian suffering in Gaza, And so a day later, Malloy and Conway sent a separate email titled An Apology to sincerely apologize for their first email condemning anti-Semitism. That is, the Rutgers College leaders apologized for condemning anti-Semitism and then fell all over themselves doing so. Wow. The administrators said the intent of the initial email was to affirm that Rutgers, New Brunswick, is a place where all identities can feel validated and supported, but added that the impact of the communication fell short of that intention. In hindsight, it's clear to us that the message failed to communicate support for our Palestinian community members. The Rutgers Hillel noted, as if condemnation of anti-Semitism is some form of anti-Palestinian sentiment? Malloy and Conway also wrote, the university was enriched by our vibrant diversity, and diversity must be supported by equity, inclusion, anti-racism, and the condemnation of all forms of bigotry and hatred, including anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. As we grow in our personal and institutional understanding, we will take the lesson learned here to heart and pledge our commitment to doing better, their email said. We will work to regain your trust and make sure our communications going forward are much more sensitive and balanced. The administrators ended the email by saying they hope to learn from the mistakes along the way. In an outstanding response, the Rutgers Hillel said, the university has demonstrated a pattern when it comes to recognizing prejudice and bias. Jews don't count. The university seems unable to recognize that Jews are a vulnerable minority and that anti-Jewish prejudice is real. This repeated erasure of Jewish concerns and identity is painful and bewildering to every member of the Rutgers Jewish community. Or as Senator Tom Cotton, the Republican from Arkansas, asked, how can someone this weak lead a university? The email came as the U.S. saw a massive spike in hate crimes against Jewish people from New York to Los Angeles. Well, then, last Saturday, Rutgers President Jonathan Holloway, who outranks Malloy and Conway, posted a much stronger statement called on hatred and bigotry. He wrote, Rutgers deplores hatred and bigotry in all forms. We have not, nor would we ever, apologize for standing against anti-Semitism. Neither hatred nor bigotry has a place at Rutgers, nor should they have a place anywhere in the world. At Rutgers, we believe anti-Semitism, anti-Hinduism, Islamophobia, and all forms of racism, intolerance, and xenophobia are unacceptable, wherever and whenever they occur. Of course, the president's chancellor and provost actually did apologize for standing against anti-Semitism. Exactly that. Because in the university world, if you do that, you are acknowledging that you stand against those Palestinians and their sympathizers who are flat-out anti-Semites, not just anti-Israel or anti-Zionists. They are genuinely Jew-haters, like the scum who waved Palestinian flags while shouting anti-Semitic epithets in New York and Los Angeles and, oh, by the way, London and Paris and Berlin, and who physically attacked Jews in America, as though somehow it would help Arabs 9,000 miles away. And you know, God forbid, if you condemn anti-Semites, you are apparently condemning those lovely people too. And so, if you are high up in administration at a university, you back down and publicly flay yourself. If the chancellor of a major American university apologized for condemning racism and racist violence against anybody else, blacks, Asians, indigenous Americans, Muslims, he or she would lose their job the next day. But apparently in America in 2021, if you don't apologize for condemning anti-Semitism, well, you might lose your job too. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back our very special guest, Oshrat Bar-El, our correspondent in Israel, I have to say. Although we've had the opportunity to talk before at happier times, Oshrat was for years our representative, our Mevina about Israel here, and a very important part of our Tucson Jewish community as well, it must be said. Oshrat, you know, the Gaza conflict seemed to come kind of out of nowhere this time. Usually there's sort of a buildup and there's incidents and there's an occasional rocket. This all sort of exploded quickly. Why? What are Israelis saying about why this happened when it did?
to say that it comes from came from nowhere, it's not true. And it's not me. A few days ago, the Ministry of Bitachon, of Security, Benny Gantz, Minister of Security, said that a few days, I think 10 days, he mentioned 10 days prior to the operation, to the beginning of the operation by Hamas on Yom Yerushalayim, it was a thinking of launching something to stop the here and there rockets that were sent from Gaza. So I know that many want to refer it to Netanyahu trying to have something else on the news, but his mishpat, his trial.
Yeah, but the trial, his corruption trials, yeah.
Yeah, but it won't be fair for me to, since I know, like from hearing on the news, like everyone else. So it's very fair to bring the things as they are. And you know that I'm not number one fan of Bibi Netanyahu. You know that.
I have yet to meet too many Israelis who say they are, by the way, but I do know that. Yes, of course. I guess the question
so
I
it's
had...
important for me to say that, you know, it's okay to accuse Bibi Netanyahu for many things that he did wrong, but not to lead us and to this operation just for his personal benefit. It won't be fair.
It impresses me that there were a number of factors that went into causing this to explode now. Look, there have been Gaza wars four times or something like that in the past, and there have been continued experiences of tunnels and attacks, but there hasn't been a major conflict in like 7 years. It seemed to me that there were a few factors. One was that Abbas was going to call, there was going to be Palestinian elections for the first time in 15 years or 14 years, and that he called them off, maybe because he thought he was going to lose, and Hamas needed to sort of prove its credibility. The other was that people have been locked down from coronavirus for a long time, and sort of stuff was just kind of ready to explode. And that's just my speculating from 9,000 miles away. I wonder what Israelis are saying right now after this experience of the Gaza war.
So let me tell you something. You know, firing 5,000 rockets, the ability to fire this amount of rockets from Gaza to Israel can't be arranged in 24 hours. So it won't be a crazy guess that there is a close connection between the disability of, it's not a disability, but Abu Mazen calculation that he won't win the election this time. On the other hand, and this is the 4 months, I would say, that this is going on. I mean, he tried to blame Israel, first allow Israeli, he doesn't call them Israeli Arab, he calls them Palestinian who lives in East Jerusalem to vote at the election, and then we will hold the election. Suddenly Israel is also not suddenly, always, right, Rabbi?
Yes,
Israeli
of course.
To be blamed for everything that happened. So Israel responded by saying, "Until we will, since we don't have a peace treaty signed, East Jerusalem and West Bank, not yet, not all of them, not yet included in the PA." As an entity, you can't force us to let you or let them vote for the PA. They are still residents of Israel. Did I make this point clear?
Yeah, I think so. We are in the aftermath of the Gaza conflict. During the Gaza war, we saw all kinds of terrible public relations material, for want of a better term. You can call it propaganda, but pro-Palestinian propaganda, claiming Israel was committing war crimes, that this was all terrible. The facts almost don't matter anymore. It's true that anytime you fire rockets at civilians, as Hamas sent, noted 5,000 rockets at civilians, and by the way, hit their own people frequently. Those rockets aren't very reliable. The press has been awful about Israel. I know Israelis are aware of this because Israelis are online more than any people in the world, I think. How do you think that we should respond? And obviously, we've seen anti-Semitic attacks around the world now as a response to this also. What are people saying about that in Israel?
This time, it's funny because today I had like a Zoom with the head of Hasbara organizations on a national level. Because I was really, really frustrated from all the PR, like inside and outside of Israel about the situation. And as a shlicha, I knew how powerful every post, every picture, every interview, how much is it's important, because on the other side, I mean, there is no borders. Like, they will put every picture, no matter if like they would see the dead bodies and the face. I mean, there is no standard at all to what can be published and what not. And on the Israeli side, we are very, very sensitive. That's one, but that's not the most problematic. I mean, the problematic issue is that on one hand, we are super aware to the problematic image Israel has on a regular day, I would say, and multiply it, I don't know how many, in a days of crisis. I mean, and it was like kind of a mess in terms of messages and things that we should have just released to the world. But the frustration, Rabbi, and I must say, after 6 years in the U.S., that sometimes the feeling is, no matter what we will say, okay? No matter what message we will convey or what personal stories we will share, or like there is a trend, I would say, sorry for being like so straight, but just hate Israel. I mean, sorry for not being like so vulnerable anymore. Sorry for being so successful democracy in the Middle East. We are very sorry for that. Sorry that our government take care of us and invested millions in Iron Dome. Very sorry. I mean, come on. In the same time that a nation defends her citizens by a rocket system, like Hamas, and I'm saying it's Hamas. It's not a government versus government. It's a government versus a terrorist.
Versus terrorists, yeah. Right, I say to people, I mean, you lived here. If a whole bunch of rockets were being shot from Nogales, Sonora into Arizona, or from Tijuana into San Diego, how long would it take before the United States military went in and just destroyed the whole place?
Exactly. And you know what? You mentioned Nogales. It's a good example. I mean, in terms of what the point I wanted to make about the election, just imagine if Mexico would say, we want the citizen of Nogales, the part of Nogales that's in the U.S., to vote for Mexico. Okay,
yeah.
It's the same. It's the same. I mean, if it sounds like crazy, so I just want people to imagine. That's the situation. And to blame U.S. not to allow American citizens who live in Nogales not to vote in Mexico, it's exactly to blame Israel for not having elections the PA because of whatever they asked that I mentioned.
So, Ashrat, what was the most heartening thing, the thing that brought you the most positive feeling in Israel that happened recently from the American perspective?
Actually, really a few days ago when the U.S. President Joe Biden said in very short and sharp sentences that Israel has the right to defend itself. And peace won't come. By the way, I saw it on Al Jazeera. It's funny, but because I'm watching Al Jazeera from time to time, I saw it. So it was very, very powerful for me to watch it on Al Jazeera network to see the U.S. president say peace won't come to the region unless the neighbor countries will recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And if I remember right, he even repeat this sentence. I mean, this was so powerful for me, and was a little bit light in this darkness of all this media that was so flushed with hate, hate to Israel, and I would say even a little bit in some places, hate to Jews. So hearing of Jews around the world and in America, in Brooklyn, in other places, afraid, afraid and trying even to hide a little bit. I don't know how much of this you felt in Tucson to hide their Jewish identity, but taking off the kippah or hiding the mezuzah or things like that, that I know because my aunt lives in Five Towns, Long Island, and so I know it. It's not that I'm guessing it or I read about it. I know it from my aunt. So in this darkness, I said these sentences of the U.S. president brought a lot of light and hope that the people that I want them to hear this voice, because these are the audience hearing it very loud and clear.
I want to thank Oshrat Bar-El for joining us from Israel and sharing some of the stories from the recent conflict and her extraordinary perspective, and a perspective that I should say is also of light, almost always, even in a dark time. Oshrat, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
I hope we talk again soon. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Manus Friedman, discussing lessons learned from the pandemic. Our playout this morning comes from a Yiddish shtetl song, basically kvetching about life, to bouncy little joyful music. How Jewish. Too Jewish. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha this Friday night or Saturday morning for services and Onig Shabbat and Kiddush Friday nights at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning at 10 a.m., Torah study beforehand at 9. Just be sure to email me if you want more information, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Wenn ich bin 13 Jahre alt geworden, bin ich geworden bar mitzvah. Ich bin gegangen arbeiten, nicht kiemen, sie kein Kitzvah. Sie Kitzvah bin ich gekiemen, nicht so das viel gehabt. Der Schaffer hat mir die Kopf verdreht, wenn ich war Luft und nahe, ja. Ich hab geschrieben, neu, in mein Bad gestellt, die Liebe. Treffen soll die Sonne, wie sind wir getroffen, die Klippe. Komm, will man hasse die Uwe, ist man ärger wie geschmeckt. Man wird schon bald bei drüben, es muss und bewahre, ja. Sieh man doch und Masel, doch und Masel, doch und sieh man doch. Sieh man doch und Masel, doch und Masel, doch und sieh man doch. Sieh man doch und Masel, doch und Masel, doch und sieh man doch. Thank you.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.